welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to your Gladys and Potties, Classic LNL, each Friday night, repeated early on Sunday morning, a program from our archives from the past 15 years. This time, a particularly odd conversation I had back in 1993 with scientist, author, and one of my dearest friends, the late Darryl Rainey. Thank you, Johann Sebastian, and welcome back to Late Night Live, revered listener. A difficult program for me tonight. I'm going to replay for you my chat with Darryl Rainey, and I've got to tell you something of the circumstances of what turned out to be an extraordinary and fateful broadcast. I met Darryl about 10 years ago when he'd made an ABC series called Genesis at about the same time that Carl Sagan made his Cosmos, and I thought Rainey's program was every bit as good, if not better. Darryl and I have been arguing about science and religion, about God and meaning ever since, and it's been a close friendship, and we've had umpteen discussions on the wireless over the years. Well, I thought this would be yet another one between books. Darryl's last book, The Death of Forever, has been an enormous success, and his new book is on the way. So Darryl came in and we chatted. He was very distressed before, during, and particularly after the program, which he thought was a catastrophe, and we all sought to reassure him that it had been just fine. But Darryl felt very odd, so he went to the doctor, and he found that, in fact, he was dying. Now, I don't, you know, that's not something you say lightly, but Darryl has always been candid about life and death, and so he wants you to know. That's exactly the circumstances of this program. Since then, I've sat with Darryl at his deathbed on many an occasion, and we've continued our discussions. He's an extraordinary human being, and although we don't agree on the big issues, I am very proud to present this final chat with Darryl Rainey. And it began with me putting to Darryl one of his central propositions. Darryl says that science has removed a sense of the sacred and now may be the agent that restores it in the crisis of the meaning of life. And I asked Darryl to prove that to me. I told him that we disagree, we apprehend a different universe, and yet both of us share a sense of the transcendent. Is that what you argue that science has taken away, Darryl? How has science taken away? Convince me that it has.
No, I don't think so. I think for the past century anyway, science portrayed a kind of mechanical universe in which we human beings were accidental irrelevancies. And this came about from many fields of scientific endeavour. In biology, we had the replacement of purpose by chance. In physics, we had the Newtonian universe in which there was the overriding paradigm of the great clockwork mechanism. I think this has outlived its usefulness. I think that science itself is turning against that mechanical universe it sought to portray 20 or 30 years ago. And I think there is, for the first time maybe ever, a genuine rapprochement possible between the leading voices of science and those of religion, as you know.
You insist that our culture emphasises head at the expense of heart. Does it go further than science?
Well, I suppose you're right in one respect, Philip, that we all see in our portrait of reality that which we wish to see. And I would argue that we arrange our model of the universe, in a sense, to fit our own preconceptions. I can see the way you're going to take this from here on.
Well, no. Let this lie on the table. Let me try this with you. Paul Davies admits that, or suggests that, he started his explorations as a scientist, at least as an agnostic. I think he was talks about being an atheist, and little by little came to suspect that this was not the right answer. Is that true of your intellectual trajectory, Darryl?
I came to suspect it was not the right answer.
Did you begin your intellectual life, or your adult intellectual life, as an agnostic or as an atheist?
Well, yes, I did. I came from a family that was profoundly hostile to religion. My father had been to World War II, and seen all the pointless bloodshed that ensued as a result of that conflict and come back. He'd gone a Christian. He came back a very bitter man indeed, and that bitterness scarred my life. My mother was a rationalist, so I was brought up in a family that was in a profound sense hostile to the entire religious tradition. So that was the mindset against which I grew up. But as we've discussed before, and this is something I'm not comfortable talking about on air, when I was 18, my mother died under very unfortunate circumstances, and I just started university, so that for me, what was in the original stages of my university study, a mere intellectual game, as it is for most students, I think, all of a sudden became deadly serious. For me, it was a matter of literally grim, simple survival to work out whether there was a meaning or a purpose to life. And from that time onwards, this has been the overriding motivation to try and work out whether, in fact, underlying all of this, there is a purpose or whether it's all a meaningless game.
And you are increasingly exhilarated by the thought that it does have meaning, aren't you?
Look, this is where I get so frustrated with words. I mean, on one level I could say, yes, of course I am. On another level I could say, of course I'm not. It comes down to something which I think simply cannot be conveyed through words. I think someone said, it may have been Charles Birch, it may have been someone else, that religion, for example, is experienced first and you spend the rest of your life trying to explain it. I see the insights, the deep insights of modern science, as in a quite profound way validating many of the insights of the sacred tradition. For example, just take the one simple insight that all is one. This is very much a core insight of each and every sacred faith. And this is very much where modern science is leading us, the understanding that to explain anything, you must explain everything. There is a deep sense of holism built into the modern concept, for example, of quantum mechanics.
Dale, forgive a sort of a crude lay view, but I would have thought that the notion of all being one is almost painfully self-evident, that that almost everyone must feel or sense that.
Well, one can say that, and yet in our everyday life, we act in just such a fashion as to almost prove the opposite. I mean, we act as though we, in our individual egocentric view of the universe, are the centre of the cosmos. We put self ahead of other in almost all of our daily activity.
But many many religious beliefs tend to do that. They put God outside and treat the rest of it, the other, you know, the temporal world, with some contempt.
Perhaps. I mean, I find that difficult. I mean, I know that in their practice, many of the organized religions do the very converse of what their deep spiritual insights suggest they should. What's that wonderful saying of I think it was Louis Mumford, that it's been the tragedy of the founder of every great faith to have had resurrected in his or her wake the very barriers they labored to cast down. So there is a sense in which in the practice of religion, people deny the truths which the founder of that religion attempted to put in place.
Yeah, but but I wasn't trying to sort of knock religion. I was listening to Paul Collins the other night on one of his admirable religious programs for Radio National, and he was having a discussion with a Russian Orthodox theologian who was making the point that Russian Orthodoxy has tended to be more holistic than, for instance, the mainstream Catholic Church, that it puts God in everything, whereas, I'm sure you're aware, other theologies puts God separately. And this can manifest itself, I remember, for instance, in that extraordinary performance of Ronald Reagan, Secretary of the Interior, who you might remember had to be removed from office because he was so convinced that the second coming of Christ was imminent that he thought it was fine to cut down all the trees and mine in national parks. I mean, what I'm disputing is that all religions have this sense of reverence for everything. Many religions, it seems to me, have very little reverence for this world.
But I think you must draw a very deep distinction here, Philip, between the people who found a great religious tradition and those who come in their wakes. That was the meaning of the statement I made before, that it's been the tragedy of the founder of every great religion to have had resurrected in his or her wake the very barriers they labour to cast down. In other words, I think the person who begins a great religion, take Jesus if you want to be contentious, has had a profound spiritual insight, something which in our modern culture we only see in glimpses in, for example, the near-death experience. Now, people who come along in the trail of that pioneer have not had that deep psycho-spiritual insight. They find themselves struggling for words to describe that which is untellable in any words that are. And I think you have the old confusion between the symbol and the substance. That the person who starts the religion off, who has this deep peak experience, as Maslow called us, this numinous experience, that person has seen a reality which is simply ineffable, which is numinous. The same kind of thing one has when listening to a great piece of music or standing out under the night sky. We've discussed this on air before. So I think that the pioneer has this profound insight, this moment of aha, this what in science is called a eureka moment. But because this moment it cannot be captured in words, those who come behind, who follow in the footsteps of the pioneer, are literally at a loss for words in many situations. And in their endeavours to recapture that first numinous moment, to understand the truth of what that first person understood so clearly, they inevitably muff it up. They get it wrong.
I have some trouble with even this idea of a person originating a religion. I don't know who can claim that for the Hindu faith, for instance. I know you could point to Buddha, but certainly Jesus Christ doesn't just pop up. His views are evolutionary views. They come out of earlier religious beliefs.
But they're not in the context of his time, Philip. I mean, I think, and what happened to Jesus of Nazareth, I won't say proves, but suggests this very clearly. I mean, he was, in the context of his time, very much a rebel. And I think his insight was so deep and so original in the context of both Jewish and Roman Palestine that it was absolutely inevitable that he would stir up some kind of hornet's nest and suffer very much the fate that he did.
I think we'd better leave this discussion to Barbara Thiering. Let's now come back to this point. You're suggesting that each of these great religious originators had a luminous or numinous insight, which may be beyond sort of verbal expression, but which is so profound that it sort of resonates through history, and now their truth is being in some way picked up by scientific progress or scientific theories. Give me a for instance.
Well, one that I'm very fond of, as you know, it doesn't spring directly from the Christian tradition, but many poets down the centuries have had this profound insight that we have some connection with the stars. Now, what modern science says unequivocally is that we are the children of the stars. If you look up at the night sky and you feel that deep primordial sense of connection with those far-off lights, and you ask yourself the question, is this just romantic fantasy? What modern science would say quite unequivocally is no, it is not. Because apart from the atoms of hydrogen, which were born in the so-called Big Bang, every other atom in your body was born in the burning heart of a giant star. So in a literal scientific sense, we are children of the stars. We are star stuff made conscious. We are a cosmos awakening in self-awareness, seeking to understand what it was, so that it can see what it is, so that it can understand what it may be.
Which religious traditions argue that we are children of the stars?
Yes, no, so I was trying to cover myself against that earlier on when I said this doesn't spring directly from any of the spiritual traditions that I'm aware of, but it nonetheless is
it
part of that
same... It sounds
same
like one, I must admit, doesn't it?
But it does, indeed. Yeah, it's part of that same poetic spiritual tradition to which I would see all the great sacred traditions conforming.
I'm not trying to be antagonistic here, Darryl.
Sure.
I'm just trying to tease out ideas. Okay, that's one, and you've already mentioned the big one, which is the holistic proposition. Is there another? For instance, let's deal with the one which is so intriguing to you personally. Most great religions postulate some survival of the ego after death. Is there any evidence from your scientific speculations or from even more from, is there any scientific evidence that this could possibly be true?
Well, I think all the great religions unite to deny what you've just said, that they would say that ego does not survive death, but consciousness does. There's a profound difference between the two. Are you with me?
Sure. I'm slapping my wrist for being verbally sloppy. Now, go on.
No, ego doesn't
survive, but consciousness, something. Some scintilla of identity.
Well, I wonder about the word identity. I mean, in my second book, Song of Geringia, I've tried to go into this. This is one of the most difficult areas for any scientist to speak about without surrendering his or her scientific credentials. And I know you're going to try and tease me out on this. All I can say is that the modern quantum mechanical view of reality would hold that anything, for example, take the smallest one of the smallest particles we know, an electron. That has a fundamental duality, which we call a wave-particle duality. It can be described on one level or in one sense as a wave, on another level in another sense as a particle. And those two sides, wave and particle, are indissolubly coupled. Now, we live in a particulate or material world. And yet, what quantum physics says, and many people are uncomfortable with this, that particulate world is, in a profound sense, a creation of consciousness. In other words, you cannot take consciousness out of the picture without in some way collapsing it altogether. And if you're going to talk about the survival of consciousness after death, my proposition, and I find this extraordinarily difficult to condense into a few simple words, and I can hear my scientific colleagues jumping on me, you know, right, left and centre, all over.
Darryl, they're not going to jump on you tonight. You're safe, you're among friends, and take your time.
Okay. Well, it is a very difficult proposition. Take for example, the speed of light. Now, in modern physics, this is an absolute barrier only if we're talking about entities which have a particulate character. What relativity says in that context is quite simple. It is simply this, that anything from the scale of an electron up to a human being or whatever, anything that has mass cannot attain the speed of light without that mass increasing to infinity. In other words, there is an absolute barrier to any object with mass ever attaining the speed of light.
Yep. Remember that, okay, from science classes.
Okay. But that does not mean that information in some form cannot travel at or beyond the speed of light. For example, the radio waves that are carrying my voice and yours at this very moment, they are travelling at light speed. So the information encoded in this interchange between you and me is quite literally and factually travelling at the speed of light. Now, what I'm saying is that the speed of light in this context should be thought of less as a motion or a movement than as a dividing line or threshold between two alternate forms of reality. And it may be, this is purely a speculation, it may be that life and death conform to the same principle. That while we are trapped, as it were, in this particulate reality, that we have certain limitations enforced upon us by that very fact. And that at the moment of death, when our particulate structure dissolves, the what I would call the wave nature of consciousness becomes paramount. And this would explain many, many features of the near-death phenomenon.
You're listening to Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC Online and Pod. And this interview with molecular biologist Darryl Rainey was first broadcast in June 1993. I've just been reading, Darryl, your D.O. Williams Memorial Lecture that you delivered in New Zealand a couple of days ago. Yeah. Science and the Search for Meaning, Implications for Psychotherapy. And you start raising the near-death experience notion very powerfully in this. Now, I have lots of difficulties with this, Darryl, but yeah. Be my guest, literally.
Well, as you know, I wrote a book called The Death of Forever, whose primary premise was that consciousness survives death. But so many people have come back to me since and said, look, you know, you hold out these tantalizing glimpses, but what do you really mean? And at that stage, when I'd finished that first book, I had never heard of a near-death experience. Up to that point in my scientific career, it belonged in the same fringe category as UFOs, poltergeists, and what I considered then, a load of intellectual wank, excuse the expression. And shortly after I'd finished the book, I was watching a Couchman program on ABC, and all of a sudden, I realized here in experiential form was the message of my first book. Here were living, breathing human beings putting forward in their own fumbling way exactly the insight that I'd tried to capture in The Death of Forever. So, not unexpectedly, the phenomenon bowled me over. I now have an entire library on the subject. I have gone into it with a scientist's scepticism. I have tried to shoot it down by saying it is one of the hallucinations that the dying brain puts up to soften the fact of its own imminent extinction. I've looked at the pharmacological explanations in terms of for example, the effects of drugs like ketamine, which mimic some of the experiences which near-death experiences report. But I have to say, at the end of the day, there is a phenomenon there. It cannot simply be explained away. Well, you can try and explain it, but you shouldn't try and explain it away.
Mm. Well, Darryl, I know three people who have had the experience of dying and coming back. You know one of them, and that's Robin Williams.
Yes, yes.
I won't embarrass the others by naming them, but none of them report near-death experiences. They said they just simply bloody well died, and Robin did it a couple of times. And so how do you account for the fact that that finely honed brain of Robin's didn't have a near-death experience?
Well, Kenneth Ring, who's one of the world's leading authorities in this area, put that very question to Raymond Moody, who started the whole thing off, if you like, in 1975, I think it was, with his book Life After Life. And Ken said, look, you know, why is it only one person in three reports a near-death experience? And Raymond's reply was a masterpiece. He said, I haven't the foggiest idea, Ken. In other words, nobody knows why, on average, only 33% of people who are clinically dead for a small period of time go through this experience. I certainly wouldn't pretend.
Well, let me suggest something to you, Darrell, and that is that the three people I know who died didn't expect to have one. Perhaps it's culturally determined. See, I've read a lot of this stuff, and a lot of people write to me about it, and one of the things that intrigued me was the nature of the near-death experience, the images or the metaphors that pop up in them, have gone through a curious sort of cultural evolution over the years. I can remember early reports always involved a gatekeeper who talked about hell and heaven. Well, hell seems to have been faded away a bit these days in theological disrepute. You know, in other words, the story changes, and it seems to have a rather fashionable execution these days.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, people of different ages and races and genders and backgrounds all report essentially the same near-death experience. So if it was simply culturally determined or culturally programmed, one might expect the form of it to vary much more than it does. As I understand it, and I could be quite wrong, but as I understand it from my reading and from people I've spoken to, what is called the core experience is very much a universal constant, as though the human brain experiences a universal cognitive shift at the moment of death.
Well, describe that core experience as you understand it.
As I understand it. Okay, there are many elements to it, but the core experience would go roughly as follows. That there is, first of all, a sense of what is called medically dissociation. Many people experience a feeling of being outside their body. People who've died, for example, of cardiac arrest find themselves hovering above the bed, looking down on their own physical person. Then there is a sense of passing through what many people interpret as a long tunnel.
Mm.
Then, and here is the interesting part, there is a sense of coming into the presence of some ineffable light. And people are unanimous in saying this light is not just overpowering, it is all-knowing, it is complete transcendental love. Some people who go very deeply into the experience report a phase beyond that, but here it becomes very much individual and the sort of the universalist component fades away.
Okay, now what you're saying, Darrell, is that you have checked out this phenomenon, put it through the scientific sieve and find that there's no pharmacological or other reason, other scientific reason for it that you know of, and therefore it has authenticity. What does that tell you?
Well, let me pick up a point. I mean, if you're determined to explain it away, not explain it, you can write it off in terms of pharmacological models. I mean, this is true of any field of human endeavour. If you're just determined to explain something away, you can always find an explanation. You can dress it up in pseudoscientific jargon. So that if your mind is so conditioned to the conventional scientific paradigm that you will not allow any kind of reality to the near-death experience, then it's possible to throw up all sorts of models, and I've seen this done.
Well, Darrell, you mentioned UFOs before. You would certainly dispute the UFO phenomenon. You would, in fact,
skeptically
examine it, attack it, wouldn't you? You'd scrutinise it, you'd apply Occam's razor.
Yes, all of that.
Yeah.
But I think the near-death experience, I mean, a recent Gallup poll has shown that I think it was 3 million, anyway, many millions of Americans have had a near-death experience. And the clinical
gosh, I wish you weren't talking about Americans. They have some very strange experiences. Is there a sane society that you can describe?
Well, what about Australia?
Yes,
Dr. Cherry Sutherland has...
We're pretty sane. That's okay.
...has just published a survey of several hundred Australians who've been through an NDE, a near-death experience. And again, her findings confirm what has been pioneered in the USA by Kenneth Ring and in the UK by Margot Gray. So,
and they're not all responding to the fact that NDA, what do they call them? Near-death experiences?
NDEs, near-death experiences.
Are now regularly discussed in sort of tabloid newspapers and magazines and even in feature films. You not think they're simply recycling these sort of notions in the same way that channelers feed off each other or other occult marketeers?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I mean, I cannot compellingly say that I can prove it to you in terms that a scientist would accept. But I mean, this my own, having looked at the literature, and Dr. Kenneth Ring, who's one of the world's leading authorities, will be here in Australia in August, and he could answer this aspect of the discussion better than I. But having examined the evidence,
okay, we'll just push
as
on.
It comes to me, I would still say that there is a reality there which I think cannot be explained away in terms of simplistic scientific models. So, I mean, what it says to me is that one must at least seriously entertain the possibility that consciousness survives death as we know it. And I find very little difficulty in this if you look at an alternative model of consciousness based upon a model of the brain that was put forward a couple of centuries ago, I think, by the German philosopher Schiller, and which has been reactivated in our time by Rupert Sheldrake and others. Now, Sheldrake is not a popular scientist. He's a bit of a maverick. But if one just looks at the situation in terms of pure, simple logic, the two models of the brain contrasted would be as follows. The one is that consciousness is 100% a function of the electrochemistry of a living brain. That the phenomenon we call consciousness, our ability to perceive and understand reality, is very much arising.
Brain-bound, brain-contained.
It's brain-bound.
Well, it's
brain contained.
That's my position, of course. Yeah.
Yes, it is your position. Now, Sheldrake put forward, I think, a very interesting alternative. He said, pardon me, imagine an extraterrestrial, an ET that arrives from another galaxy and is watching the moving picture on a television screen. And it's intrigued by this, so it decides to try and find out where that picture comes from. So being a good scientist, what does it do? It takes the TV set apart. It examines the cathodes and diodes, the electrodes, the wiring, all that stuff. But no matter how much it analyzes, no matter how much it dissects, it cannot find out where the picture is coming from in terms of dissecting the television set itself. Because the picture is contained not in the hardware of the TV set, but in the electromagnetic field surrounding it. Now, this alternative view of the brain, I think, is the one which is basically correct.
Darryl, let's explore that after we have our promised loo break for the listener. What we're going to do is have a little Johann Sebastian, who, of course, regularly provides our theme. This is Sonata No. 2 in A minor, the Allegro movement, and it's played by Uta Ugi.
Okay.
Thank you.
coming at you at the speed of light on Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Johann Sebastian Bach. And you're listening to an interview with my long-dead pal, the late Darryl Rainey, one of Australia's best-known science writers and communicators, who held an unusual mix of tertiary arts and science qualifications covering history, German science, up to PhD levels in biochemistry and molecular biology. When I first met Darryl, he'd just written and produced the ABC TV series Genesis, which predated Cosmos, Carl Sagan's effort, by about a year. And Darryl always wanted to prove through his science that there was some sort of life after death. His 1993 book, The Death of Forever, A New Future for Human Consciousness, sold at least 15,000 copies.
Now, Darryl, before we had our little musical break, and I know you love music and you argue that music is a better form of communication than words, you were putting words together to persuade us that that the second model of the mind, or the brain, was the convincing one for you. Would you pick it up again?
Yes, well, I suppose the question would be for many scientists, if you take this model of the brain as analogous to a receiving set, like a television set, what is the field of consciousness that surrounds it? They were saying, well, where is it? What is it? I would argue that it is the unobserved structure of physical reality itself. If you look at what modern quantum science says about an electron in its unobserved state, it is described in scientific parlance as a wave of probability. But it's equally correct to describe it, as I prefer to, as a ripple of possibility. And if you sort of run through the characteristics of an electron in that wave-like form, it starts to sound very like a thought. Very like a thought.
Well, so I remember Koestler making this point on a grand scale, saying that to him the universe was rather like a vast consciousness, just sort of brooding and considering possibilities. You're putting that right down to the micro level.
Well, I think I am. I mean, Sir Arthur Eddington, one of the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, said the universe is beginning to look much more like a great thought than a great machine. And I think that's a very profound insight. And I think it's David Bohm. Now, he's regarded by many physicists as something of a maverick. But he said there is a point-by-point equivalence between the way our processes, I'm paraphrasing this, but this is the sense of it, our processes of logical thinking operate and the processes of quantum mechanics. And it would be strange if there was not some correspondence between the two. Now, that's not an exact quote, but that's the sense of what he was trying to say. There is a deep, and to me anyway, convincing equivalence between the quantum mechanical description of an, for example, electron in its unobserved state, and what we consider to be the inner nature of the mechanics of thought. And I would argue that any model of consciousness that does not have a quantum mechanical basis is, in the long term, likely to be false. Now, I mean, this is, if you don't understand quantum mechanics, I mean, one could say, so what? But Roger Penrose, for example, who is Stephen Hawking's colleague, and I think in many ways his superior, has written a wonderful book called The Emperor's New Mind. And he makes the same point quite convincingly, or quite compellingly, in my view, that there has to be, if in any complete explanation of consciousness...
I think Penrose is fascinating, and I like his attacks on the artificial intelligence community. He's a very interesting writer. But let's go back to this. Is it Sheldrake's proposition that if someone comes along and looks at the TV set? Darryl, in the case of the TV set, a good scientist might go on and discover where the television transmitter was. He might sort of discover there was a television station beneath it sending out the signals. So in your model of the brain, from whence are the signals coming?
Well, I'm saying that the brain is analogous to a receiving set, which is tuning into a field of consciousness that surrounds it. Now, if you ask where that is coming from, here you enter one of the very simple yet subtle aspects of quantum mechanics, which I think is one of the great barriers to its understanding by the ordinary person. There is a deep sense in which space and time themselves are constructs. They are not fundamental givens, they are constructs. And if you look again at my example of an electron, what the quantum mechanical view of an electron states is this: it does not exist anywhere or any when. Do you understand that? It does not exist anywhere or any when.
I understand the words. I've never been able to understand what you're actually saying on this.
Okay. But it does not inhabit the space-time construct that we know. So to ask where in space or time this quantum mechanical view of consciousness originates, I think, is to distort the question.
Do you and Paul Davies agree on this issue, incidentally?
Well, I've never had the chance to sit down and discuss this with Paul in depth. I mean, we've talked both privately. We've never talked publicly, actually. We've talked privately about some of these issues, and I've read his books and he's read mine. Look, I mean, I wouldn't, especially
no,
in a public
just forum curious,
like this.
Just curious.
No,
about
I haven't.
Mm. Okay, well, let's leave that aside and look at another area. There's something else that you and I have discussed from time to time. Mm. And it's a proposition that pops up in the writings of others. It's not your argument so much as others, but the nature of a self-apprehending universe, of consciousness in the universe, as being almost a counterbalance to the notion of entropy, to the notion of the second law of thermodynamics.
Yes, yes.
I've heard you argue, and it's a very interesting argument, that God may not exist and may never have existed, but could, in a sense, be coming into existence because consciousness is growing and spreading throughout the universe. And you believe that it may be possible, I understand, that one of these days consciousness will not be locked up in little, within separate skulls, but may in fact start to link, merge, blend, that we may be on the at the beginning of a new era of consciousness.
Yes, absolutely. I think here is one of those few instances where the scientist can speak, I won't say with some authority, but where, by using the empirically demonstrated data of modern science, you can paint a picture which is at the very least plausible. If we look at what science says, it is simply this, that the universe, the cosmos as we know it, came into existence 15 billion years ago approximately in the so-called Big Bang, the Genesis event, the singularity that began it all. And across that mind-bending span of time, there have emerged in succession electrons, that is, subatomic particles, atoms, galaxies, stars, planets, life, consciousness. Or, to put that in terms that the average person can relate to in a different way, from the first atoms that were formed shortly after the Big Bang, and they were hydrogen atoms, the simplest elements in the periodic table of the elements, have come what? What has 15 billion years of evolution produced from those primordial hydrogen atoms?
Mm.
It's produced the underwater flight of dolphins, fractal images on computer screens, the laser light of cognitive awareness. All of this richness has come about in 15 billion years of evolutionary time.
So now, why should there not,
no
this
sense,
process continue?
Why should it stop?
Yeah.
I mean, there is nothing special about this moment in time, apart from the fact that we coincidentally happen to inhabit it. Mm. I mean, this I will say with total conviction, both from logic, from common sense, and from intuition. I mean, okay, well, you talk about the moment of a particular time, and you take that time as having some absolute value. You could look at your watch and say it's 12:05 or whatever. But in point of fact, if you'd picked on the moment of 12:05 as it is your time, it'd be some quite different hour
somewhere else
in the time zone of somewhere else.
Sure.
So this is the whole insight of relativity. So there is nothing, if you take the evolutionary moment that we inhabit as human beings on this planet, there is nothing special in an evolutionary sense apart from the fact that we happen to inhabit it. And I would argue from profound conviction that the evolutionary experiment cannot stop here.
Mm.
Unlike many people who have a religious conviction, I do not believe that we are foreordained to carry the evolution of consciousness forward. If we snuff it on this planet, as we will may do, I think the torch of evolving consciousness will
go somewhere, sure.
Elsewhere.
I have no difficulty with that. Daryl, let me circle right back to the motives for these for your explorations. Mm. When we first met, I remember discussing death with you. Death was something of great importance to us as an idea, and you and I would both agree that the dread of death has been a powerful motive force in many, if not all, religious explorations. Do you find your growing suspicion or hope, I think is probably a better word, that consciousness may survive death, do you find this reassuring to you personally? Because others who have read your book still say, that's terrific, that's great, but it doesn't help me locked in my little bubble of consciousness. I'm still going to die. I'm still going to cease to exist and be in that non-existent state for billions of years. Do you find these ideas that you're coming up with personally soothing?
No, I find them just the reverse. I think this is one of the messages of the near-death experience that people simply do not want to look at. Now, it's interesting that some of the people who've investigated the phenomenon in depth believe, obviously, honestly, that everyone who goes into a near-death experience goes into this transcendental state of ineffable love. In point of fact, there is good evidence that many people go into something approaching the converse, and one of the other universals of the near-death experience is what is called the panoramic life review. Now, what this says very simply
is your life flashing before you, routine.
But it's not just seeing your life, Philip. I mean, what these people report very clearly and very categorically is that all the pain you have caused, you feel. Now, I can recall going along to a lecture given by Cherry Sutherland and trying to be a smartass and saying, okay, talk about this. Let's talk about this panoramic life review. I cannot believe that Adolf Hitler will go into the same state of all-forgiving love as Mother Teresa. And she shot back with what I now believe is the correct answer. She said, I would hate to be Adolf Hitler during a panoramic life review. Because in this sense, I believe the great religions of the world got it right. There is an accountability. There is an accounting. What you have made of your life.
Well, Daryl, this can only happen, Daryl, if there is an accountant. Surely, you're suggesting that there is some form of great accountant up there, not the God of the gaps.
No, absolutely not. This is one thing that the people who have had an NDE are very clear on. There is no external God that judges you. You sit in judgment upon yourself. And I put it to you, there is no harsher critic. There is no one as interested in the course of your life as you are yourself. This is one thing which to me anyway, and I think to anyone who's come close to the near-death experience, is absolutely and crystal clear. There is no external God. The person who sits in judgment on one's life is you yourself. The only thing which appears to happen is there is a point of absolute comparison, which is the sense of all-forgiving love. So if you compare, if you run your life past yourself, and there is no way to describe in words the way this happens, it seems to occur in that state of timelessness that the mystics speak of, but if that happens using love as a yardstick of comparison, most of us would fall so woefully short that we would experience what one American near-death experiencer has gone through. He says, and I wish I had the exact quote in front of me, he said, there is no way you ever get over what you lived through in those few moments when the whole of your life goes before you and you realize, using that yardstick of absolute love as a comparison, that you have in a deep sense failed to fulfill the trust that was vested in you.
This is Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and Pod, and this conversation with the late Dr. Daryl Rainey, molecular biologist and author, was first broadcast in June 1993.
Daryl, does it worry you? I know it does, but I'm going to put it to you publicly. Does it worry you that you are, to some extent, being appropriated, as is Paul Davies, by a lot of New Age people whose sensibilities you would otherwise, I think you would find ridiculous?
Yes, it does. It bothers me a lot. I mean, one of the great dangers of all of this, and one of the reasons why from time to time, like now, I feel very inclined to do what my father told me when I was 10 and close my mouth. Much of what is being said by science at its cutting edge, and a lot of what is being said by the people who've had a near-death experience, can be and is misunderstood. And it is not my intention or my function in any way to give comfort to the people who believe that the universe will look after us. I believe exactly the converse. I think if one looks at what, for example, Jim Lovelock meant with his Gaia theory, which is simply...
it's a tough theory if you analyse it. It's not a sentimental view, is it?
It's not sentimental at all. What it says is not that Gaia will look after us, but that Gaia will look after herself, which means that Gaia will get rid of any component of the Earth's biofeedback system which is disrupting the functional integrity of the whole. And at the moment, if there is anything in that feedback loop which is threatening the biosphere, it is the human species. So I don't in any sense share this New Age optimism that the universe will take care of us, not one little bit. I think we are challenged in this planetary near-death moment we're living through as never before in evolution, to act in a responsible way. And I think the choice is literally ours. As the French biochemist Jacques Monod said, neither our duty nor our destiny has been written down. The choice purely and simply is ours.
Daryl, when Carl Sagan was, obviously followed in your footsteps with Cosmos, he scooped up a handful of sand at one point, let the grains trickle through his fingers, beautifully backlit, like Carl was so often backlit in Toto. And he said there are about 10,000 grains of sand in the average handful. trickle, trickle, trickle. There are more suns up there than there are grains of sand on all the beaches on Earth. Now, a little frisson of excitement, the hair on the back of the neck prickles. I have a sense of the numinous when I think about that. But that, to me, confirms what I've always felt, and I emphasise felt rather than known, that we are a very, very minor life form on a very minor planet, on a rather undistinguished galaxy, on the edge of, you know. In other words, we are not important. Your belief, your evolving belief, dare I say, and to some extent Paul Davies, refutes that. You both seem to be saying that human beings are pretty significant in the scheme of things. I know you've just said that if we die out, it doesn't matter, that the torch of consciousness will be picked up by some other critter. But nonetheless, both of you seem to be saying that we do matter.
Yes, it's all a matter, I think, of confusing the relative importance of quantity and quality. And that is really important that people understand this. Science is laid, because it's mathematical and numerical in its very essence, science is laid overwhelming importance on quantity, on measurement. But what we're starting to understand is that quality is just as important in the scheme of things. I mean, how do you measure the size of an idea? If you look at what has happened across those 15 billion years of evolution that I spoke of before, it is quite true that in terms of numbers, in terms of measurement, the evolution has been winding down in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics. But coupled to that winding down, there has come this building up of complexity, which has, on this planet, around this particular sun, led to the evolution of consciousness as we know it, represented in us at this moment in evolutionary time. And the point that people like John Wheeler make, the point that I make, the point that Paul Davies and so many other scientists make, is that we can no longer exclude consciousness from our perspective of what matters. I think Stephen Hawking's model of the universe, as portrayed in his book The Brief History of Time, will go down 200 years hence as the greatest failure, a magnificent failure, but the greatest failure in the history of scientific ideas, for simply this reason, that it is the last, to me anyway, the last great, totally mechanical model of the universe. It places no importance, it doesn't even mention, in a fundamental sense, consciousness. And if there is one simple message of quantum mechanics, it is simply this, that consciousness enters into the structure of reality in a fundamental way. So that we, who are, as far as we know, the only conscious beings in the cosmos, I mean, I personally believe there are others, but as far as we are scientifically and empirically aware, we are the only conscious beings in the cosmos. We are the carriers of a torch, which, if you look at John Wheeler's participatory model of the cosmos, in theory at least, had the capacity to summon the entire cosmos into reality through what's called causation. Now, this is.
I hope you're listening to this, listeners, because you're going to be asked questions afterwards.
Well, I mean, this is, again, I wish I had a blackboard here. I mean, at the end of Paul Davies' book, The Mind of God, there is a drawing of John Wheeler's idea of the participatory cosmos in the form of a gigantic U with this huge eye, which represents human intelligence, somehow summoning the whole of material reality into being through the act of consciousness. That is an extreme position which many scientists would not espouse or agree with. What is indisputably true in the modern quantum mechanical perspective is that you cannot take consciousness out of it. It is through consciousness that we know the universe.
Sure.
It is because of consciousness that an electron, to go back to that example I used before, has a particulate structure as opposed to a wave structure. Consciousness is central to this quantum mechanical perspective of reality. So that to simply excise consciousness in the interests of so-called objectivity, as so many scientists have done, is in a deep sense non-scientific. The people who do this, who cling to this objectivist paradigm, I think are failing to understand the very science they call on for their endorsement.
Darryl, finally, of all the forms of language in which you deal, which do you find the most appropriate or the most useful? I know you feel that music is one. What about mathematical formula? Is that a higher form of language than the one we're employing now, you and I?
I'm not very good at maths. I mean, Paul Davies would undoubtedly say, yes, there is a profound symmetry in many of the mathematical equations of modern science that many people are drawn to. For example, I think it was the physicist Paul Dirac who said it's more important to have beauty in one's equations than to have them fit the experiments. That's a very extreme statement. So if one looks only at mathematics, even there one has the sense of aesthetics, the sense that somehow beauty is in a deep sense related to truth.
Mm. Well, that's very much Paul's argument, isn't it?
This is right. For me, I admit I'm not a very good mathematician. I find that sense of beauty in music in a more experiential way. And it is fascinating to me that the modern quantum mechanical view of matter is in a deep sense musical.
Darryl Rainey, molecular biologist and author of many books, including The Death of Forever, A New Future for Human Consciousness, and Music of the Mind, An Adventure into Consciousness, both published by Souvenir Press. Darryl always had to believe that there was life after death, but I have to say that on his deathbed, he told me that he thought he'd been kidding himself. He died in 1994, not long after the broadcast you've just heard. We'll have another classic L&L for you at the same time next week, but for now, stick around on ABC Radio National for the news, and we'll see you later.
ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.